The last case set for argument this morning is Appeal Number 30579, James and Amber May versus First Rate Excavate. Justin Clark is present, will be arguing on behalf of the appellant plaintiffs. And Ryland Deinert is present, will be arguing on behalf of the defendant appellee. So, Mr. Clark, you may proceed with your initial argument.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
Justin Clark on behalf of the appellants James and Amber May. The circuit court erred when it applied the economic loss doctrine to this case and dismissed the May's complaint. As the court is aware, a motion to dismiss requires the court to accept the facts as pled and reasonable conclusions to be drawn therefrom. It must appear beyond a reasonable doubt the plaintiff can prove no set of facts in support of his claim entitling to relief. Here, the Mays hired RES Construction to build a home. RES selected First Rate to perform the digging for the foundation, the placement of the foundation, and the placement of the septic system. After completion of construction, water infiltrated the Mays home numerous times, and the septic system failed as it was underwater. The Mays filed a lawsuit against First Rate Excavate, alleging that First Rate breached the duty it owed to the Mays to perform its work in a workmanlike manner. The circuit court dismissed the complaint on the basis of the economic loss doctrine. Respectfully, the economic loss doctrine has no application in this matter. Simply put, First Rate had a duty independent of any contract to perform its work in a workmanlike manner.
Can I ask you this, Mr. Clark? I know you've raised an issue and said the court erred by sort of raising this sua sponte.
Yes, Your Honor.
That being the case, assume he was right. Does that matter in terms of our decision in this case, the fact that the court may have taken on the role of an advocate and stepped out of the, assuming that's what he did, and became an advocate rather than a neutral? Does that matter if he was right?
Well, thank you, Your Honor, for the question. We believe that raising the issue sua sponte is a reversible error in and of itself. And given the facts as they are here today, we believe that would be reversible error in this case.
He gave you the opportunity to brief it, both sides.
Yes,
fully brief it, and then orally argue it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But I suppose that wouldn't be very satisfying if your client perceives that the judge gave the other side a winning argument. If your client perceives that the judge gave the other side a winning argument, that might not be very satisfying.
Yes.
So even if you get a chance to brief it, still might not be all that fulfilling if your perception is that this was nowhere on anyone's radar screen until the judge raised it and then adopted it. And your client may well think that but for that, we would have tried this one the way it was teed up.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. If I may continue, I would discuss the non-contracting parties' status of First Rate and the Mays in this case. First, the economic loss doctrine does not apply to between non-contracting parties. As this court decided in Chrysler's, the doctrine limits a contracting party's remedies to those in the contract, meaning it precludes those outside of the contract. This court declined to expand the economic loss doctrine beyond commercial transactions, as well as noted in Chrysler's. The plain language of Chrysler's is clear. The economic loss doctrine applies in the context of contracting parties. Here, the Mays and First Rate both contracted with RES and were therefore indirectly linked by contract. We explained that in our briefing. In accord with the majority position identified by the restatement in our briefing, the economic loss doctrine does not apply to these non-contracting parties. The Mays should not be barred from seeking tort remedies and left with no remedy for First Rate's negligent work, especially when there's an independent duty to perform their work in a workmanlike manner, as there is in this case.
So wasn't there relief in that the Mays entered into a settlement agreement with RES and there's a Perringer release?
That's correct, Your Honor. The Mays did enter into a release with RES on a Perringer basis. They reserved the right to pursue claims against any other persons or entities for damages. The release is a common one in practice, as we've seen. We cited to the case from Minnesota, the Minnesota Court of Appeals, Lansing versus Concrete Design Specialties. And in that case, the Minnesota Court of Appeals ruled in applying the terms of the agreement that the settlement agreement between a homeowner and the general contractor, which reserved claims and did not list one of the subcontractors as a relief as a released party, did not release that subcontractor. And the same is true here. Now, with regard to the non-contracting party status of the parties, we cited to the case of Sullivan from the Arizona Supreme Court. We believe that case is instructive. In Sullivan, the court declined to extend the economic loss doctrine to non-contracting parties. They're relying upon the restatement. The Arizona Supreme Court pointed out that the majority of courts apply the economic loss doctrine only to parties that have contracts.
So you had noted, counsel, that there was indirect privity here between RES and First Rate. In Sullivan, we have a contractor who sells the house to the buyer, who then sells the house to the plaintiff. So we have a severance of privity. Does that make Sullivan distinguishable?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that there is no privity, if you call it indirect or characterize it in any way. You'd have to have a contract to have privity. There's another case that we've identified, Village Homes of Grandview Square 2 Association versus REC. This is a Minnesota Court of Appeals case. And in that case, they've determined that the case from Peranto, also a Minnesota Court of Appeals case, had the same facts that we have, similar facts to here. Two non-contracting parties. The developer was the non-contracting party that never was named in the contract. They determined that an independent duty existed outside of the contract to perform the work in a workmanlike manner. So under Peranto, when you have that independent duty, the economic loss doctrine simply doesn't apply to non-contracting parties.
Does it matter, and I know it's not very well developed on the record because I think there's a motion to dismiss, but does it matter the type of damages that your client's seeking in terms of the applicability of the economic loss doctrine? So, for instance, if your client's seeking cost to repair the alleged issue and defective workmanship versus some other damage to the house, things like that, that occurred as a result of the defective workmanship, does that matter?
Your Honor, with the economic loss doctrine, as it's framed under our progeny, Jorgensen and Kreiser's, there is the other property exception, and there's the personal injuries exception. We would state that when there's an independent duty, as there is here, that the damages, it does not matter. Here we have damage to the property that is independent of the foundation itself. We have water infiltration damages that way. The economic loss doctrine would prevent lost profits, consequential damages, those type of things. A good example would be for economic loss, a barge coming down the Mississippi River crashes into the bank, spills oil everywhere. The people above where the damage has occurred have lost profits because they can't get down their barges down the down the river. They can't sue for negligence because of those lost profits. That's different than what we have here. Now, when formulating South Dakota's economic loss doctrine, this court relied upon Minnesota law, which previously declined to extend the economic loss doctrine beyond commercial transactions, which are those encompassed by Article 2. Therefore, the economic loss doctrine does not apply outside of the UCC. This dispute does not concern damages incurred in the operation of a contract for the sale of goods. Here we have services, digging of the foundation and placement of the concrete for the foundation, this digging for the septic system.
Is the economic loss doctrine sort of a corollary to the independent tort doctrine?
Your Honor, I would say yes.
On the damages side.
On the damages side. It hasn't The best way to put this is there is an amalgamation of exceptions that have eaten the rule. I've read a number of cases from a number of jurisdictions trying to make head or tails of this doctrine. And in Tennessee in 2023, there's a Supreme Court case that outlines a number of these different cases and rules. And the independent tort rule is probably a better way to describe what the economic loss doctrine really is. We cited the case that has determined that foundation work and septic work is not a sale of goods, and that case was Stevenson versus Frazier from the Indiana Court of Appeals. And that's exactly what we have here, the digging of a foundation and the placement of a septic system. As we stated, when formulating the economic loss doctrine, we had not applied this outside of the UCC, as is stated in Chrysler's. As this is not a sale of goods, the economic loss doctrine simply does not apply. Now, even if the economic loss doctrine did apply, the Mays have alleged damages to other property, as we talked about a little bit with the other property exception. This court has recognized an exception in Jorgensen to the economic loss doctrine when a plaintiff's injury stems from, quote, other property collateral to the contracted for product. And it talks about product again, which then would make you think about the UCC and Article 2.
What particular damages sought by the Mays are collateral to their new residential property? What are the damages that are collateral?
Besides the property itself, Your Honor, the house?
Yes.
The yard has sustained damage. There's damage from runoff from the septic system that runs into the neighbor's property while there hasn't been a suit yet from the neighbors.
So have you put that in your complaint?
It was in the complaint, Your Honor, insofar as we identify that there was damage to other property. We didn't specifically state other than to claim damages for the property injuries that have been sustained.
So might that be a reason, maybe it's premature to even decide this question at this point in terms of we don't even know. The damage haven't been fleshed out through discovery like you'd have in a motion for summary judgment.
That could be true, Your Honor. Respectfully, I would state that the doctrine simply doesn't have any application.
Well, I understand that, but assuming we said it did apply, maybe it's premature.
That could very well be the case with the other property exception that we could identify and would identify additional damage to other property of the Mays and their neighbors due to the runoff from the septic system as well.
So you haven't pled anything regarding the neighbors in your complaint?
No, Your Honor, no. We have not specifically pled that the neighbors have made notice to us or anything of that nature regarding damages, and they've not brought suit against the Mays for the damages that have been caused at this time. As I noted, the Mays alleged damage to the surrounding land and to their neighbor's property. Therefore, if the economic loss doctrine applies to this non-UCC transaction between non-contracting parties, the Mays have alleged collateral damage to other property that takes this case outside of the economic loss doctrine. Public policy, just briefly, also supports the conclusion that the circuit court erred in holding that the economic loss doctrine applied here. The circuit court relied on a case from Texas, Land/STV versus Martin K. EB Construction Company, and holding that the economic loss doctrine should apply to non-contracting parties. There was an architect. As I mentioned in reading in preparation for our argument, I encountered the case from Tennessee called Commercial Painting Company, Inc. versus White's Company LLC, 676 Southwest 3rd, 527. The Supreme Court of Tennessee determined that the economic loss doctrine, applying it to service contracts, necessitates finding and justifying numerous and confusing exceptions. That's been the development of this doctrine. Consequently, judges, lawyers, legal scholars struggle to track the doctrine and its meaning and application and the scope within their jurisdiction. As the Tennessee Supreme Court explained in rejecting the application of the doctrine to a contract for construction services in that case, there's no compelling reason to extend the economic loss doctrine to service contracts. Doing so simply confuses the issues and applies the doctrine outside of the product's liability and the Article II liability context in which it originated. South Dakota has not done so, has not extended the doctrine outside of the UCC, as noted in Chrysler's, which was decided after the Texas Supreme Court, which the Circuit Court relied upon. I see my time is almost up. For all these reasons, the plaintiffs request this court reverse the lower court's grant of the motion to dismiss the plaintiff's complaint. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Diner, you may proceed.
May it please court, counsel. My name is Ryland Diner. I represent First Rake Excavate, an excavating company out of Sioux Falls. And in addition to the facts laid out by Mr. Clark, there's a few additional facts that need to be made. In regards to this case, RES Construction Company is a general contractor. They contracted with the Mays to build a home in Lincoln County. RES contracted with First Rate Excavate to do grading work on the yard, to do the foundation work, and to install some septic tanks. And First Rate was a subcontractor.
On a motion to dismiss, do we have those facts in front of us?
It's in the record. I don't know how it got in the record, Your Honor, truthfully, but it's in Judge Hoffman's order issuing it.
Yeah, we don't have any affidavits or anything like that. We're kind of stuck to, we're looking at the four corners of the complaint at this point, aren't we?
That's true, but at the oral argument, I wasn't there, but my partner, Mr. LaPierre, was. It was conceded from my review of the transcript that, yes, RES was the general contractor and that First Rate was a sub of the general contractor. So I don't think there's any dispute that those are the facts. And I get it, we're here in a unique procedural matter, but the idea that Judge Hoffman gave an argument to First Rate Excavate, Justice Salter said that a little bit. I take a little exception to that because that would have been an affirmative defense we would have asserted.
I was just asking. I wasn't no.
And you didn't get a ruling on your two issues that you raised.
We
right?
did not. And I want to bring up Justice Salter because I've had him as a juror, as a trial judge, and now as a Supreme Court judge.
So talking about that, your issues weren't raised. Let's assume we say court was wrong on this economic loss doctrine. You go back and you litigate the two issues that were in front of you, because they haven't really been decided, have they?
They have not been decided, Your Honor, or Justice. And I believe we would win on the privity of contract. But with that said, I also believe that the economic loss doctrine has been decided by this court, although not clearly in 1994 in the City of Lenox case. And I believe that we should be successful on that.
So doesn't your argument on the privity of contract kind of cut against the argument here on the economic loss doctrine? I mean, they're kind of mutually exclusive, aren't they?
They're alternative arguments, yes.
Right.
That's right. And with that, I don't believe there needs to be privity for the economic loss doctrine. For example, the Mays could have brought a third-party beneficiary contract claim against First Rate Excavate. They could have brought their claim against RES. RES brings in First Rate, and we settle it all at the same time, or we try it all at the same time. What the Mays decided to do was settle separately with the general contractor. And yes, their release has a small carve-out to come after First Rate, but it doesn't have any assignment of their contractual claim to go after First Rate Excavate.
But you agree this court's never extended the economic loss doctrine beyond the UCC commercial transactions, correct?
I believe there's never been a case where that's done.
Right.
I believe the interpretation of Lenox, which precedes all the justices on this court, would have allowed it, and I believe that the reason why the UCC was discussed was because it was a separate issue from the economic loss doctrine. It dealt with the building in Lenox and whether the sale of the trusses, the insulation, the sheet metal, and all that worked under the UCC. If you look at the language, as Judge Stryer says in the U.S. District Court in the Taco John's case, she, like First Rate, believes that the court didn't distinguish it because it didn't matter in that case because it automatically involved the UCC. In states like Iowa, for example, as you're familiar, Justice Jensen, the economic loss doctrine applies in a situation just like this, where a home buyer or a building buyer comes after a sub, one, they have to have privity in Iowa. But two, even if they had privity, the economic loss doctrine would prevent these tort damages. And the reason why the economic loss doctrine has been affected is to get rid of the tortification of contract law. It takes away the element of foreseeability. It makes things simpler, makes things easier. And in this case, the Mays are only seeking economic damages. Now, there's loose records and talks of maybe the neighbors will come after them. The alleged damage happened, though, in 2016 and 2017, so the six-year property statute of limitations would be expired. So now we're just being hypothetical with those kind of damages. The neighbors would have known about this damage when it happened in September 2016 and then again in 2017.
So the other hurdle you've got to get over to apply economic loss doctrine, aside from the UCC context, is this court's never applied the doctrine outside of a direct contractual privity arrangement.
That's correct.
So you got two hurdles to get over to apply the doctrine in this instance.
Well, I believe the court never specifically said no UCC.
No, I understand that, but I mean you're carving out. If we adopt this here, we're carving out and jumping way beyond where this court has ever gone before in terms of applying the economic loss doctrine. Would you agree?
I agree. I haven't found any case that's similar to this case that has ever been before the South Dakota Supreme Court. But I think it makes sense in this case because every party is called a contractor. We have a general contractor. We have a subcontractor. We have a sub-subcontractor. The title of the parties alone tell us any claim against each other is not for negligence. It's for a breach of contract or a third-party beneficiary contract and things like that. And that's why I think it makes sense that we follow Iowa and confirm in writing clear that the economic loss doctrine applies.
First Rate doesn't get paid. Who does First Rate sue to get paid?
We go after RES. Now, we could file a lien on the home of the Mays, Jimmy and Amber May. If we do it timely, I think it's 120 days, but we file a lien. If they sell the house, we get paid, or we can enforce the lien. But our direct breach of contract claim for not getting paid would be against RES. That's what I would believe.
Thank you.
The contract is not in this record at this point, is it?
It is not. It was very preliminary. And with that, though, again, there's no argument there was a contract. The argument is there a written contract or an oral contract? Because that wasn't ferreted out in the record or the facts. But I would argue and contend that that doesn't matter. Whether you have, in building trades, for example, some builders are a little more sophisticated than others, and they actually have written out contracts. I do a lot of construction defense work, and most of them are just handshakes and a couple emails. And going through that litigation is horrendous because you're reading emails and text messages because things are changing with change orders all the time.
Can you just give me a brief explanation of your lack of privity of contract, how that related to the charge or the claim brought? What was your argument? Because it was a really short motion.
Yeah, so we were arguing that there was no privity between the Mays and between First Rate Excavate. The privity of contract was between RES and First Rate Excavate. And so we are contending, but we never addressed it, was the Mays needed to sue RES, and RES would bring us in because we owed the obligation, we being First Rate, owed the duty and the obligation to our client, our customer, RES.
So it was a duty under the tort claim. You didn't owe a duty
under
to
contract.
The Mays.
Yeah, under the contract.
Well,
yes.
So they brought a tort claim, but that's why I was having you connect it to what they actually brought.
Yeah,
here.
And I would argue you have a duty under a contract, too. It's not the same as a negligence duty, for example, or a tort duty. But we First Rate, contracted with RES to install septic tanks and all that stuff. And our obligation was to RES to do that work in proper standard working manner. And that's what we believe should have happened. Or the Mays could have gotten an assignment of that claim from RES and proceeded under an assignment, which you see that happen in the bad faith insurance world all the time, where a defendant will assign their right to a bad faith claim against an insurance company to the injured party. And they'll prosecute and go after an insurance company on bad faith claims. The Mays could have easily done the same thing here and got an assignment of the claim from RES. They didn't do that. They just got a right to reserve their right to reserve their own claim, which we believe is deficient both under privity as well as the economic loss doctrine. In regards to the exceptions, we briefly touched about that. If the economic loss doctrine applies, which we believe it does, whether it's UCC or not, there's three exceptions, and two of them are real easy. The first is a personal injury. There's no allegations of personal injury in this case. The second one was, is there any form of professional negligence or malpractice? In this case, there's no architect being accused of malpractice or an engineer. It's an excavating company. The third, the other property exception, First Rate disagrees with Amber and Jimmy May. It is not applicable. This court specifically in the City of Lenox case in 1994 came out and said with that building, when there was damage to the trusses, it also caused damage to insulation, it caused damage to sheet metal, it caused damage to other components in the building when they had to remediate it and fix it. And that was all considered part of the package of the building that the City of Lenox was involved in. Here, the Mays built a brand new home from start to finish. It had excavating work, it had to dig a basement, it had to install septic tanks because it's in rural Lincoln County. It was literally stick-built and put together. That's all the entire package, just like the building was in Lenox.
So are those consequential damages then?
I think they are consequential damages in this court in the City of Lenox, as well as what Justice Schreier reiterated in the Taco Johns case. If you look at the definition that this court applied in 1994, it also includes consequential damages that relate to it, and they're not other damages. Now, this court in 1994 said other damages that would be an example would be if you buy a new water heater and it's in an old home and it blows up and it because of a gas leak or something, and the house that was there long before this new water heater was there, now that's other property damage because that had nothing to do with the installation of that water heater. It's a brand new component. Maybe it was added to the house 20, 30 years later. Or the other example this court gave was if a motorist gets his brakes fixed and they're not fixed properly, he loses control, drives off the road, and hits a house. That would be other property damage because that had nothing to do with the brake fix. The car damage, yeah, that would be considered the same damage, but we have a house that was some people are just sitting in their home and a car runs into it. That's not foreseeable, so that would be the other damages.
Is there any other property damage pled here?
There's not. In my brief, I highlight a few of the things that they say, including concrete moving or heaving, allegedly, the house shifting, as well as water pools in the backyard. That's all that I saw being pled. And then in the prayer for relief, it talks about damages for rebuilding or fixing the home, and then the generic and any other damages that, including myself and my plaintiff cases, put in there. But there's no claim about damages for the neighbors. There's no claim for damages for their car got damaged because the water flooded their car and destroyed the engine. There's no damages other than this actual home, this actual fixture that was done by RES, First Rate, and the various miscellaneous subcontractors. So we believe the other property exception does not apply. And with that, First Rate's not asking for a gazillion exceptions. I think the three standard exceptions you see in most states, including in Iowa, is if there's a personal injury involved, or if there's professional negligence like legal malpractice or engineering malpractice, or the other property. Every party is called a contractor in this case. It should be a breach of contract claim. It should be an economic loss doctrine applicable situation. We're now adding torts, and we're tortifying contract law. And I know that sounds boring, but that's the situation we're in. First Rate Excavate contracted with RES. It's not foreseeable it's going to get sued for negligence. It would be foreseeable that it would be sued for breaching a contract for not installing the septic tanks correctly, if that's true, or for doing faulty foundation work, if that's not true. So there are claims and ways and avenues to go after First Rate if they did indeed do the work improperly, deficiently, or not correctly. It's just, we're saying...
Forgive me. I have a thought in the waning moments of your... I'm listening, but I have a thought, and I just kind of want to get an answer. What would have been a best-case scenario for you if the court hadn't raised the economic loss doctrine and you would have gone ahead and litigated the motions that you had? Well, and focusing particularly on the privity one, what would have that looked like? You hit a home run on your privity, a lack of privity motion. Then what?
Then the case is dismissed because there's no claim that could be brought against First Rate because the Mays decided to just go after the general contractor and or they didn't get an assignment of RES's right to go after First Rate Excavate. So we're not foreclosing opportunities from homeowners or building owners to go after subcontractors. It's just saying you got to go in a contractual way. You can't go under tort. You can't. We're not going to tortify contract law. That's what we're saying. And I think that's kind of a theme when I was reading the briefs was First Rate saying that they can never get sued by the Mays or any homeowners. And we're not saying that at all. We're saying you have to sue us under contractual causes of action as opposed to negligence. And with that, I see I have no other time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Clark, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Can we operate safely on the premise that, and I know the claim is different, negligence is not contract, but can we operate on a relatively safe premise that the damages you would ultimately seek in this case, if it had been allowed to play out, would be different and would be greater than a contract claim?
I don't know if it, I would say that, Your Honor. I believe the damages that we seek are those which are recoverable if there was a contract, which doesn't exist here between the two parties. There's an independent duty, though. I go back to that. Every contractor has an independent duty to perform their work in a workmanlike manner. That takes us outside of the contract context. Even the general contractor, even though we have a contract with RES, they still have a duty independent of that contract to perform their work in a workmanlike manner. So did First Rate. They had that duty as well.
Who did they owe that duty to, though?
They owe that duty to any third party that is a foreseeable plaintiff. In this case, that would be the Mays. Foreseeability in this case, given that the Mays were the beneficiaries of the contract between RES and the Mays.
Why shouldn't we allow the parties to allocate risk and hold them to their contractual remedies through the economic loss doctrine?
Your Honor, if we did that in this case, it would subsume the rule of tort liability that there's an independent duty when you engage in performing your work in a workmanlike manner. It would subsume that rule completely, and we would be back to years before when contract law was the only way that you could recover. Tort law didn't exist at the time. That development of that body of law is the reason why we can bring that claim today against First Rate. Based upon that independent duty that they would owe. Now, regarding the privity of contract argument, I just wanted to touch on that briefly because you brought it up. The lower court did determine that that was in a posit, that the arguments made there. So I believe that there was a ruling on that privity argument taken from the opinion of the circuit court. And that argument was not preserved here by a notice of review. So we would respectfully suggest that that argument has been waived at this time. Now, with regard to Taco John's and applying the applying the economic loss doctrine outside of the UCC, that case was decided in 2008. That's 6 years before Chrysler's came down, and Chrysler's talked about contracting parties. And it's 2 years before that Jorgensen talks about that this applies in the UCC context, making that clear. At either of those times, the court could have expanded and determined at the time the body of law applicable here, but it has not done so. We, as Justice, you mentioned, we'd have to jump through two hoops to get to where First Rate wants us to be here today. And that was what Judge Schreier and Taco John's did that in 2008, but in 2012 and 2014, this court essentially rejected that reading of the economic loss doctrine. Now, between the no privity argument, just to touch on it substantively, as I mentioned, that would subsume the rule of tort law if you had to have privity of contract to bring a tort claim. That's just kind of counterintuitive. It would subsume that body of law. With that, I just would like to point out the Peranto case again to the court and suggest there that the Minnesota Court of Appeals in 352 Northwest 2nd 808 affirmed a district court's award of damages for negligence against a contractor. And that Minnesota is what we based our economic loss doctrine on. The court concluded that the contractor was negligent and the developer was a third-party beneficiary of the contract between the two contracting parties, there, the township and the contractor. The developer was never named in the contract. That's exactly what we have here. When an independent duty exists outside the contract, which it does in this case, a negligence claim is valid. That independent legal duty is the duty to perform work in a reasonably good and workmanlike manner. With that, I would ask that the court reverse the lower court's determination of dismissal of the Mays complaint. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. That will conclude our June term of court, and we're in recess.